Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. It's an abolitionist novel set in antebellum Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Ohio. The principal characters are Tom, a saintly old man, a slave affectionately called Uncle Tom, Eliza, a young part Negro slave woman, George Harris, Eliza's husband, also a slave, Augustine St. Clair, a rich white slaveholder, Eva St. Clair, Augustine's benevolent young daughter, Simon Legree, a cruel planter and slave dealer, and George Shelby, the son of a slave owner. The northern-based movement to abolish slavery was in full swing, and Connecticut-born Harriet Beecher Stowe was an ardent sympathizer in her 40s when she sat down 10 years before the outbreak of the American Civil War to breathe life into her idealized and long-suffering plantation slave, Uncle Tom, and the colorful galaxy of characters who surround him. Soon afterward, she found herself spotlighted as one of the foremost novelists of her age. "So this is the little lady who started this big war," said Abraham Lincoln when he met her in 1863. Ironically, Stowe's meek and patient martyr has often met with scathing ridicule among social crusaders. The character of George Harris, proudly flaunting the law and his master, and finally shooting his family's way out of slavery, is much closer to the contemporary hero ideal. But it should be remembered that for Stowe, the Uncle Tom whose name so acutely embarrasses black activists today, represented something much more than either a model or a stereotype of black manhood. Tom was her Christian paradigm, the idealized moral victim suffering through all the indignities and brutalities conferred by a deranged world on its noblest children and emerging with his soul intact. Seen in this light, Tom's gentle, optimistic endurance becomes the ultimate show of human strength. Not incidentally, it also becomes the one instrument capable of moving Tom's white masters to turn against their own worldly interests and start working for the dismantlement of the very evil that empowers them. In the end, it is not the courage of George or Eliza or the tears of little Eva, but the unquenchable forgiveness of Uncle Tom which hastens the end of slavery. A well-mannered Kentucky gentleman, Mr. Shelby, was trying to convince his creditor, a coarse slave trader named Haley, that the requital of an old Negro slave named Tom was sufficient reimbursement to settle Shelby's debt. I mean, really, Tom is a good, sensible, pious fellow. He got religion at a camp meeting 4 years ago, and I always find him true and square in everything. Though he realized that Shelby was on the verge of losing his plantation, Haley was bent on squeezing the honeycomb dry. Just then, a captivating 4 or 5-year-old little black boy entered the room. "Tell you what," said Haley, "fling in that chap and I'll settle the business, I will." "Oh, missus," cried the young child's mother, Eliza, to Mrs. Shelby after overhearing this conversation, "do you suppose massa would sell my Harry?" Stunned, Mrs. Shelby replied, "No, you foolish girl. You know your master never means to sell any of our servants, as long as they behave well." Eliza tried to take comfort from this, but later in the day she had another wrenching jolt. Her husband, George Harris, who belonged to an owner of a nearby plantation, had discovered that his master was resentful of the admiration George had won among his fellow slaves for his hard work and intelligence. "Now," George reported, "he says he'll bring me down and humble me, and he puts me to just the hardest, meanest, and dirtiest work on purpose." So George had resolved to flee to Canada and earn money to buy freedom for Eliza and little Harry. Eliza wept and embraced her husband, then watched as he fled into the darkness. Still later that night, Eliza's distress turned to horror when she discovered that the Shelbys, looking to save their plantation, had indeed sold Harry. There was no time now for useless protests. The young mother hurried to her room to pack some belongings. Then she took her son up in her arms and made her way to the cabin of Uncle Tom. As soon as Tom and his wife Chloe opened the door, Eliza blurted out her news. Shelby had sold both Tom and her own little Harry, and she was running away with the little boy. Chloe tried to convince Tom to flee with Eliza, but he refused. "It's better for me to go to the new plantation," he explained, "than to break up the place entirely." Then, staring at his own brood of children, his pride and joy, Tom began to sob. The next morning, Haley set off on horseback in pursuit of Eliza and Harry. But when he caught up with them on the banks of the Ohio River, Eliza, nerved with strength that God only gives the desperate, seized her child and raced to the water's edge. With one wild cry and flying leap, she vaulted sheer over the turbid current by the shore onto the raft of ice beyond. It was a desperate leap, impossible to anything but madness and despair. With wild cries and desperate energy, she leaped to another and still another cake, stumbling, leaping, slipping, springing upwards again, till dimly, as in a dream, she saw the Ohio side. Across the borders of a free state, Eliza was led to a refuge in a Quaker shelter for runaways, and miraculously, George was eventually guided to the same house. But soon after the family's tearful and joyous reunion, they learned that Haley, still bent on reclaiming his prize, had commissioned two unsavory slave hunters to scout the area for Harry. Under the cover of darkness, the runaways fled again. When the bounty seekers managed to track them down, George dispatched one of them with a bullet, and at last the fugitives made their way into Canada. But at the Shelby plantation, Haley was furious that Harry had escaped. Still, he came to take possession of Tom. The grizzled old slave bid his heartbreaking farewell to his own family and to Shelby's adoring son, young Master George, who promised to someday buy Tom's freedom. Then, chained to Haley's wagon, he followed it down the road. During the voyage down the Mississippi to the New Orleans slave markets, Tom's quiet demeanor impressed even the callous Haley. Unshackled, the old man was allowed to come and go freely. In his walks on the boat's deck, Tom soon became acquainted with little Eva St. Clair, a beautiful white child who often made secret visits to the slaves in their chains, sometimes with her hands full of food for them. One day, as little Eva stood on the dock with her father, Augustine St. Clair, she suddenly lost her balance and fell sheer over the side of the boat into the water. In a moment, Tom was after her, saving her life. The next day, the grateful St. Clair purchased Tom from Haley. After returning to New Orleans with the St. Clairs, Tom became the family carriage driver. He soon learned that his wealthy new master loved his daughter above all else, and that he also cared deeply for his slaves. In fact, St. Clair even allowed little Eva to read to old Tom from the Bible. Everyone on the estate loved good-natured Eva. Even a mischievous, ragamuffin little slave girl named Topsy succumbed to Eva's kind nature. "Oh, Topsy," Eva told her one day, "I love you and I want you to be good." Eva's heartfelt kindness made Topsy weep, and thereafter she tried hard to behave. Thus it was that a great gloom spread over the entire estate the day news came that little Eva was dying of a fatal fever. Flushed and tearful, the child told her father, "I feel sad for our poor people. I wish, Papa, they were all free." "Oh, Tom, my boy," wailed the distraught master as the old slave held his hand, "it's killing me." Moments later, Eva's suffering ended. A glorious smile came over her face, and she was gone. In the dismal days that followed, St. Clair made plans to follow his daughter's dying wishes and free his slaves. Before the formalities were completed, however, St. Clair himself died in an accident, leaving his widow with the task. Marie St. Clair, the stepmother of poor little Eva, had long berated her husband for his wild, extravagant notions about the dignity of slaves. At her direction, Tom was sold to a particularly loathsome planter named Simon Legree. Upon his arrival at the new cotton plantation, Tom despaired at the bleak sight of the slaves in Legree's charge, human beings of whom nothing good was expected and desired, and who, treated in every way like brutes, had sunk as nearly to their level as it was possible for human beings to do. Two specially trained, singularly brutal black overseers stood guard over the laboring slaves. One day, a guard saw Tom trying to help a sick and feeble woman with her work. Immediately, he took a whip to the old man. Later, Legree demanded that Tom himself flog the woman. Horrified, Tom refused. "Massa," he said, "if you mean to kill me, kill me. But as to my raising my hand again anyone here, I never shall. I'll die first." Tom was beaten savagely on the spot and then dragged to an old, forsaken room. Later, a slave woman named Cassie sneaked in to tend to his wounds. Cassie told him her own story, recalling the agony of having her daughter sold to another master before she herself was forced into Legree's bed. When Tom urged her to trust in God, Cassie shook her head. "There's no use calling on the Lord," she said. "He never hears." Not long afterward, Cassie ran away with another slave woman, and Tom was accused of complicity in the escape. "Well, Tom," roared Legree, "do you know that I've made up my mind to kill you?" "Oh, massa," replied Tom, "don't bring this great sin on your soul." Unmoved, Legree summoned his guards. "Take every drop of blood he has until he confesses," he commanded. Then he watched while Tom was beaten senseless. But when Legree had stalked off, the guards tended Tom's injuries. "We's been awful wicked to you," they cried. Tom's reply came tenderly. "I forgive ye with all my heart." 2 days later, George Shelby, now a grown-up young gentleman, arrived at Legree's plantation. George had not forgotten his childhood promise to purchase Uncle Tom's freedom, but it was too late. "Oh, Massa George," Tom sighed from his cot, "the Lord's bought me, and is going to take me home." Moments later, he died. When Legree strode into the room, grinning, George knocked him flat upon his face. Then he took Tom's body up onto a shady knoll nearby and buried it, vowing, "I will do what one man can do to drive out this curse of slavery from my kind." After leaving the plantation, George ran across Cassie in the company of another runaway, Madame de Tou, on a riverboat going north. To his delight, he was able to help them. From his own family plantation records, he soon ascertained that Cassie was Eliza's mother and that Madame de Tou was George Harris's sister. With this knowledge, the women were eventually able to locate their families in Canada, where they celebrated a joyous reunion. Meanwhile, George Shelby returned home to Kentucky. True to his word, he freed his slaves. As they circled around to thank him, he pointed to his old friend's cabin. "Think of your freedom every time you see Uncle Tom's cabin, and let it be a memorial to put you all in mind to follow in his steps and be honest and faithful and Christian as he was."
This is the end of Side A. Please turn the tape over to continue on Side B.
Anna Karenina is a tragic love story by Leo Tolstoy. It's set in Moscow and St. Petersburg, Russia, during the 19th century. The principal characters include Anna Karenina, a beautiful young woman, Alexei, her cold, vindictive husband, Count Vronsky, a young military officer who falls in love with Anna, Stepan Oblonsky, Anna's spendthrift brother, Dolly, Stepan's frustrated wife, Kitty, Dolly's sister, Levin, Stepan's rustic friend, and Kitty's suitor. Stepan Oblonsky's wife, Dolly, had discovered that her husband was having an affair. With her beauty fading and her household a wreck, she had had enough. Stepan fretfully wrote to his sister, Anna Karenina, asking her to come to Moscow and convince Dolly not to leave him. Later, while working at his job in the entrenched Moscow bureaucracy, Stepan received an unexpected visitor. Levin, an old friend from the university, came to discuss Dolly's sister Kitty, whom he wanted to marry. After being informed by Stepan that he had a rival for Kitty's affections, a certain Count Vronsky of St. Petersburg, Levin resolved that he would propose to Kitty that very night. At that same moment, Anna and Count Vronsky were riding together in a train bound for Moscow. Vronsky noticed the charming woman as he made his way to the first-class compartment that he shared with his mother. He had time to take note of the suppressed eagerness which played over her face as their eyes met. and she remained in his mind. However, upon reaching their destination, the two went their separate ways, Anna to her brother's home, Vronsky and his mother to a hotel. Approached by Anna, Dolly at first refused to discuss her husband's infidelity. "Everything's lost after what has happened. Everything's over," she raged. But finally, she relented to Anna's pleas to keep the family together. Meanwhile, Levin had arrived early at a dinner party hosted by the parents of Kitty and Dolly, determined to make his desires known to Kitty before the appearance of the rich and handsome count. "But that cannot be. Forgive me," Kitty replied upon hearing his stammering proposal. Crushed by the rejection, Levin escaped from the gathering at the first opportunity. A few days later, at her coming-out ball, Kitty couldn't help but notice how Anna and Vronsky kept gazing at each other. Vronsky's face had a look that puzzled her, like the expression of an intelligent dog when it had done wrong. It was clear to Kitty that the two were in love. Nevertheless, with her task of seeing to Stepan and Dolly completed, Anna boarded the next train for St. Petersburg. She thought of her son, Seryozha, and her husband, Alexei. "My life will go on in the old way, all nice and as usual," she thought. But she found that she could not easily dismiss Count Vronsky from her mind. And stopping along the way, as Anna stepped out for a breath of air, there he was. "You know that I have come to be where you are. I can't help it," confessed the officer. Anna was both delighted and flattered by this, but it was simply unthinkable that anything could come of his attraction to her. After all, she was a married woman. Back in Moscow, Kitty was devastated. Not only had Count Vronsky spurned her, but Levin had also left the city to supervise work on his country estate. Humiliated and distraught, Kitty became so ill with despair that she was soon unable to eat or sleep. The frantic parents, after finding no restorative medical treatment in Moscow, sent her to Europe to consult various doctors. Meanwhile, life for Anna in St. Petersburg remained strangely unsettled. The happiness that in Moscow had fairly flashed from her eyes now seemed hidden somewhere far away. To her further disquiet, the love-struck Vronsky took every opportunity to see her. One night she knelt and begged him to leave her in peace, but still he persisted. "I can't think of you and myself apart. You and I are one to me." And at that moment Anna let her eyes rest on him, full of love. Soon afterward, Alexei Karenina walked into a party and found his wife with Vronsky. But Anna denied any impropriety. Still, she and Vronsky met night after night, with Alexei seemingly powerless or unwilling to stop them. Anna by now felt so sinful, so guilty, but still she could not curb her passion for the Count. The following summer, while staying at her husband's villa outside the city, Anna confronted her lover with an announcement. She was pregnant. Though he understood the gravity of Anna's position, Vronsky smiled. This was the turning point he had been longing for. "Leave your husband and make our life one," he implored. But Anna shook her head. If she left, Alexei would take sole custody of Seryozha, and she would not be allowed to see her son. But Anna did promise Vronsky that she would tell her husband the truth about the child she was carrying. When Anna made her confession, Alexei, instead of showing jealousy or indignation, merely warned his wife against public displays of flirtation. His sole concern was to preserve his social and business reputation. A duel or a divorce would only serve to disgrace him. The family cannot be broken up by a whim, a caprice, or even by the sin of one of the partners in the marriage, he informed Anna. Our life must go on as it has done in the past. Anna reacted to his words at first with guilt and shame, but this quickly turned to anger. He knows that I can't repent, that I breathe, that I love. He knows that it can lead to nothing but lying and deceit, but he wants to go on torturing me. Vronsky also was increasingly anxious to begin a new life with Anna, who would not leave her son. And so the position was one of misery for all three. Kitty had by now returned to Moscow, feeling somewhat better, One morning, just after dawn, Levin caught sight of her in a carriage as it skirted his estate, destined for her family's summer home. The pangs of love, long since buried, welled up in him once more. Months later, taking advantage of a trip to the city, he called again upon Kitty. It was apparent to both that they cared deeply for each other, and, after a proper courtship, they were united as man and wife. Levin, for years caught up in trying to find out who he was and where he fit in God's universe, had finally and happily found his place. But in St. Petersburg, relationships were breaking up. The nearer Anna came to the birth of her child, the more demanding and cold Alexei became. Then Anna survived a deadly fever to give birth to a baby girl. Oddly, the difficulty of the birth eased the tensions between herself and her husband. At the other extreme, Vronsky saw no end to the barriers separating him from his lover. Desperate at the prospect of living without Anna, he unsuccessfully tried shooting himself. Still torn, Anna finally did move in with him, and soon the couple left Russia to live in Italy for a time. Meanwhile, Kitty and Levin were living on their estate outside of Moscow. Levin felt gratified to be spiritually sustained by a loving wife. Like Anna, Kitty went through a difficult pregnancy, but it culminated in the birth of a fine little boy. Theirs was an idyllic life. Upon returning from Italy to St. Petersburg, Vronsky and Anna found themselves ostracized. Gossip followed them everywhere. The couple argued frequently, and Anna, in a burst of depression, finally accused Vronsky of being unfaithful. Even after they moved into a newly inherited estate, Anna felt alone in the world. She revived her habit of taking a little morphine to help her sleep, a legacy from her pregnancy. Summer turned to winter, and the family relocated again, this time to Moscow. There, the badly strained relationship fared no better. Though Anna pled for Vronsky to love her and give her security, at the same time she increasingly insisted on greater freedom. "This is becoming unbearable," Vronsky screamed one day. "Why do you try my patience? It has limits." Anna could only gaze at him with terror at the undisguised hatred in his whole face. Vronsky checked himself. "I mean to say, I must ask what it is you want of me." "All I want," she replied, "is that you don't desert me, as you think of doing. I want love, and there is none." Vronsky vainly protested. He would never cease to love her. Suddenly Anna turned on Vronsky, cursing him for the sacrifices she had made to be with him, her marriage, her son, her social position. Delirious with bitterness, Anna had no place to turn. Vronsky, she was convinced, had found another, and she could never return to Alexei. Ambling into the train station, she purchased a ticket. Then, standing on the platform, watching the trains, she said to herself, "I will punish him and escape from everyone and from myself." Measuring both the speed of the oncoming train and her resolve to end her suffering, she jumped. Something huge and merciless struck her on the head and rolled on her back. "Lord, forgive me all." Anna Karenina was dead. Leo Tolstoy is considered one of Russia's greatest 19th century novelists, an honor he shares with Dostoevsky. Tolstoy, however, focuses his novels on the vicissitudes of the upper classes rather than on Dostoevsky's underprivileged peasants or criminals. Tolstoy foresaw the end of the aristocracy in Russian society. Serfs had already been set free. The working class was beginning to expand in power. Moreover, new mores and morals were being imported from the West, and society's upper crust was the first to feel the strain of these changes, a strain running an undercurrent throughout Anna Karenina. The novel reads like a soap opera, with the exhaustive cast of characters continually creating their own problems. Contrast Anna's tragic quest for love and personal fulfillment with the spiritual odyssey of Levin. Through hard work and the support of an understanding family, his search is rewarded by happiness. Thus, Tolstoy's gripping masterpiece revolves around the dissimilar paths of these two characters, allowing a forum for the author's commentary on Russia's maze-like social system fraught with unresolved incongruities. Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy is an impressionist novel set in 19th century England. The principal characters include Tess Durbeyfield, a beautiful farm girl, Alec D'Urberville, her wealthy suitor, and Angel Clare, her lover, and later her husband. "Don't you really know, Durbeyfield, that you are the lineal representative of the ancient and knightly family of the D'Urbervilles, who derive their descent from Sir Pagan D'Urberville?" the parson asked. "Never heard it before, sir," said John Durbeyfield, a penniless chicken trader. "Well, it's true." Once Durbeyfield had digested this news, it was not long before the entire village had heard about the distinguished heritage of Sir John. John and his wife soon began a busy round of pub-hopping to celebrate their newfound nobility and formulate plans for reclaiming the wealth of the D'Urbervilles, leaving their oldest daughter, Tess, with the chores of caring for her six brothers and sisters, making deliveries for her father, and dragging her parents from the pub each night. Then, after an accident killed the family horse, Mrs. Durbeyfield dispatched Tess to see Mrs. D'Urberville, one of their newly claimed relatives who lived close by. It was suggested that after telling Mrs. D'Urberville of their kinship, Tess might appeal for money to purchase a new horse. At the D'Urberville estate, Tess was greeted by Alec D'Urberville, the woman's handsome yet manipulative son. Alec explained to his attractive visitor that his invalid mother was unable to appear. He also revealed that his family were not in fact D'Urbervilles at all, but from a line of Stokes who had simply appropriated an unused title as their own. Though the young man made her vaguely uncomfortable, Tess chatted politely for a while, then took her leave, unaware that she had left her host enamored and intrigued. Thus the thing began. She was doomed to be seen and marked and coveted that day by the wrong man, and not by a certain other man, the right and desired one in all respects. Days later, Tess received a letter, ostensibly from Mrs. D'Urberville, but actually written by Alec, inviting her to come and manage the D'Urbervilles' fowl farm. At her parents' urging, she agreed to go. For weeks, Tess labored at the D'Urberville farm, all the while hounded by the infatuated Alec. At every opportunity, he tried to force himself upon her. She held off his advances until one night when she accepted his offer for a ride home. On the way, Tess fell asleep. She was still deep in slumber when Alec veered off the main path. When she awakened, they were lost in a dark fog deep in the forest. Out of fright and exhaustion, Tess finally succumbed to Alec's passion. Soon afterwards, Tess learned that she was pregnant. Ashamed, she returned home and recounted what had happened. Her mother, only mildly shocked, was disappointed when Tess told her she was not going to marry Alec. Tess spent most of that winter indoors to hide her swelling belly. Then, after the child was born, she returned to work in the fields. Just a few months after its birth, Tess's baby died. She tried to give it a Christian burial, in spite of the fact that it hadn't been baptized. The sorrows of the past 2 years had taken their toll. Longing to start a new life away from her heartless parents, Tess took a job as a milkmaid in Talbothay, a village to the south. Once she had left home, she became more and more hopeful that she could put the past behind her. She settled comfortably into her new position, boarding with a dairyman, his family, and three other milkmaids, Marion, Izzy, and Reddy. Though the male hands good-naturedly teased Tess, she ignored them all. Then one day, Angel Clare, a fellow farm worker, came to call on Tess. She recognized instantly that Angel was intelligent, educated, and something of a dreamer. He was also unimpressed by religious dogma and saw nothing special in Tess's D'Urberville heritage. He told her that he was apprenticing at the dairy in order to someday establish a farm of his own. Hearing of his high aspirations, Tess seemed to regard Angel Clare as an intelligence rather than as a man. The three other dairymaid boarders were fascinated with Angel and talked about him constantly. Tess, for her part, tried to persuade Angel that any of the three would make a worthier companion than herself. Angel, however, was captivated by Tess, and despite her protests and lack of formal education, he found her an exceedingly novel, fresh, and interesting specimen of womankind. One day, when Tess and Angel were alone, he took her by the arms and pulled her close to him. She was at once pleased and distraught. The experience with Alec was still too near the surface, and she was afraid to tell Angel of her past. Angel sensed her discomfort. After apologizing, he reprimanded himself for allowing his feelings to overcome his judgment and left. But Angel soon returned to ask Tess to marry him. At first she hesitated. Though she loved him, she felt she could never be worthy of him. Nevertheless, after much persuasion, Tess agreed to marry Angel on New Year's Eve. But as the marriage date drew nearer, she fell into despair. How could she reveal her secret and still keep Angel's love? A few weeks before the wedding, Tess resolved to tell Angel about her past. Since she could not bring herself to confront him in person, she wrote him a letter and slid it under the door of his room. She was puzzled the next day when Angel, cheery as usual, said nothing about the letter. Finally, the day of the wedding arrived. Still guilt-ridden and baffled by Angel's reaction to her confession, Tess went to his room. There she found the letter, unopened, still jammed under the carpet near the door, just as she had left it. Panicking, Tess tried again to confess her secret to Angel, but he put her off. They could trade confessions after the wedding, he said. So the simple ceremony took place as planned, and the newlyweds left for their honeymoon at the old D'Urberville family manor. During dinner that night, Angel announced that it was time to set the record straight. He had earlier had an encounter with a prostitute in London. Relieved beyond measure that his confession was so similar to hers, Tess related the events that had marred her own past. But to her utter dismay, Angel, the angel whom she had always known as so generous and charitable, would not forgive her. "Forgiveness does not apply to the case," said her new husband. "You were one person, now you are another." Beneath his layers of kindness and generosity, Angel was, in fact, a moralizing hypocrite. He could not love someone who had proven to be so different from the pure and innocent young girl he had imagined. To avoid a scandal, Angel refused to accept a divorce. At last, he gave Tess some money and sent her away with the hope that they might reconcile at a future time. Angel's family, waiting eagerly to meet his bride, was naturally disappointed when he returned home alone. He explained that his plan was to open a farm in Brazil and gave them the impression that his wife would stay with her family until she could join him there. Meanwhile, at her home a few miles away, Tess, feigning that she was happily married and would soon join her husband in South America, turned over half the money Angel had given her to her family and left in search of employment. A letter from Marion, one of the Talbothay milkmaids, informed her of a job on the Flintcomb Ash Farm, a place as bleak and formidable as its name. The labor there turned out to be brutal. But worse, at Flintcomb Ash, Tess discovered that after rejecting her, Angel had asked Marion's friend Izzy to accompany him to Brazil. This revelation shattered any hope for reconciliation. On her way into town one day, Tess passed by a large crowd gathered to hear a preacher. The preacher's voice was a familiar one. It was Alec D'Urberville. Alec had apparently repented of his predations and become a barnyard preacher. Tess hurried away, but not before Alec had sighted her. Not long afterwards, Alec showed up at Flintcomb Ash. Converted to Christianity, the preacher had come to an understanding of his moral obligation. Now his wish was to wed the woman he had dishonored. Tess begged him to leave. She was already married. But Alec insisted that she forget about her estranged husband and marry him instead. Following months of Alec's vows and visits, Tess wrote a last impassioned letter to Angel, imploring him to come back or send for her before something regrettable happened. In the meantime, Tess learned that her parents had taken ill, and once again she returned home. Life there became progressively hopeless. First her father died, then the lease expired, and the family was turned out of their house. Resolved in his pursuit of Tess, Alec proposed that the family stay at his estate. She initially rejected his offer, but facing the prospect of being homeless, she relented. Once she was installed at the D'Urberville estate, Alec convinced Tess to marry him. Meanwhile, Angel had made his way home, sick and weak from the hardships he had suffered in Brazil. Deeply moved by the pleas in Tess's letter, he was now determined to find her and make amends. When he found her, however, Tess greeted him with sobs. "It is too late," she told him. "Alec has won me back to him." When the confused and painful exchange was over, Alec angrily inquired about Angel's visit. Tess turned and rebuked him bitterly. "You have torn my life all to pieces. My sin will kill him and not me. Oh, God, I can bear this no longer." Alec's only response was to mock her, cursing Angel to her face. At this, Tess seized a knife, thrust it into his chest, and ran from the house. "I have killed him," Tess confessed when she reached Angel's side. "I have done it. I don't know how. Still, I owed it to ye and myself, Angel." Embracing desperately, they took a vow never to part again. Fleeing into the woods, the couple came to an abandoned house, where they remained for 5 days. At last, in quiet and seclusion, they found the bliss that had so long eluded them. On the 6th day, they moved northward to Stonehenge. But feeling that her fate was closing around her, Tess made Angel take a vow. For her sake, should anything happen, he should marry her younger sister, Liza Lou. Angel promised to abide by her wish. The next morning, Tess was arrested. She was sentenced to hang for the murder of Alec d'Urberville. From atop a hill, Angel and Liza Lou watched as a black flag was raised, signaling that Tess's worldly trials were over. Like many of Hardy's works, this novel was publicly rejected due to its dark and sensual themes. Hardy eventually turned to poetry, forsaking novels entirely. The plot of Tess is built around an indiscretion. At first, it appears the author condemns Tess for her act and sides with Angel Clare, whose very name connotes virtue. However, as the story progresses, the reader is led to feel that Tess is the one who has been ill-treated by the monstrously cruel, self-righteous Angel. This growing sympathy for Tess, along with the portrayal of Alec as a scheming, sadistic predator, leaves Tess somewhat justified in her killing the man who has destroyed her life. Indeed, afterwards she is granted a brief measure of happiness with Angel, but the author never quite condones her crime, and in the end justice prevails, as Tess is punished for what she has done.